Hey friends, Meg Meredith here, your host on this podcast. Look, we live in a polarizing world. There's plenty that we can disagree on, but I'm pretty passionate about the fact that people and stories matter. In fact, I kind of think it's the point of life, people and stories. Sometimes we'll agree, sometimes we won't. Either way, there's always something we can talk about.
Hey y'all. Before we jump into the interview, I just want to acknowledge that it's been a hot minute and this one's been in the hopper for a while. But I'm glad to be able to finally bring you the interview with Sheila Ray Gregoire about her newest book, She Deserves Better. So, if y'all are ready, here we go.
Hello, Sheila.
Hi, it's great to be here today.
It's so good to have you back.
Yeah.
You just launched a new book in April, She Deserves Better.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually took some time off. I just started my master's program. And so in some ways, my listeners will feel like you were just here. But actually, it's been a whole year. And you've been busy.
Oh, yeah. It's been crazy this year with more research. And yeah, with the book launching, it's really exciting.
Yeah. How's the launch going?
Incredibly well. You know, when we wrote The Great Sex Rescue, we thought that was going to be our big book. And people were saying, you know, how validating it was and how freeing it was, which is great. But then this book really flowed out of that because people were saying, you know, I don't want to give those toxic teachings to my kids, but what do I do now? And so,
right,
you know, we surveyed another 7,000 women for She Deserves Better, and looked at how experiences as teens impact women long term. And people have just really been resonating with the message. I think there is such a hunger out there for a different way forward, where we're not objectifying women, where we're seeing women as whole people, where we're giving women permission to have a voice. And I think people really desperately want that.
I'm so glad it's being received well and it's going well. I want to start, we're going to jump in and dive into all the good stuff from the book, but I want to start just by giving you a chance to introduce you and your team, because you wrote this book as well as The Great Sex Rescue with two other women. And for my listeners that aren't familiar with your whole team, could you just tell us a little bit more about you three and how that kind of came together as the three of you?
Yeah. So when we were working on the blog, so I had these two young women working with me. One of them was my daughter, who had just graduated from psychology. So she has a psychology degree with an emphasis on stats and psychometrics. And she was busy getting pregnant and she just didn't want to work outside the home. So she thought, hey, right, working for mom will be fun. And I really needed her too. And then Joanna Sawatsky was a family friend that we had met through Bible quizzing. She has a master's in epidemiology and she's a statistician, but she was working for me while she was postpartum and wasn't working outside the home. So I had this little team of young millennial women, and we started to see how harmful a lot of evangelical work is, specifically around sex and marriage.
Yeah.
And I was just in this unique situation where I had two women who were qualified to do research with me that I couldn't have done on my own. So Joanna Sawatsky is our stats person. She analyzes everything. Rebecca writes our surveys and conducts our qualitative research, our focus groups and our lit reviews. And then she helps me edit. And I like to say that all the snarky lines in the books are hers. So, together, Rebecca Lindenbach's my daughter, Joanna Sawatsky is our stats person. And it's just such a huge undertaking because these aren't normal books. These are based on these massive studies and I couldn't have done it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Throughout this book, all three of you share your diverse experiences with purity culture and dating and even sex ed, which I would imagine your experiences and then hearing from those 7,000 other women and girls, their experiences is what led you to write this book. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share two quotes that I really loved that I felt like kind of encapsulated the why behind the book. So I'm going to read both of these quotes and then give you a chance to just kind of respond or elaborate on those. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The first quote, is women are finally saying enough. The Great Sex Rescue offered them a way forward, but it left them with one big question. If the church has primed so many women for body image issues, sexual dysfunction, and even abusive marriages, how on earth are Christian moms supposed to raise their daughters? I loved that one. And then the second one starts, Christian parents in the past were given a shortcut. Don't trust the world, just trust the church. In the last 10 years, that Christian bubble has popped. Parents today are woefully aware that the Christian subculture they so gladly embraced as adolescents did not provide the safety that it promised. The sexual abuse scandals, the devastation left in the wake of purity culture and mass church exodus, these things have made it impossible to ignore any longer. The bubble that may have kept some harmful stuff out, but it also allowed a different form of harm to grow unchallenged. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, response?
Yeah, that's really the focus of our book, because so often when you look at Christian parenting advice, it's how to keep your kids safe from the world. Yeah. Right? And so it's the world that is seen as corrupting our kids. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The world very well may corrupt your kids. Okay. There's lots of books on that. That's not what this book is. What she deserves better is we looked at how the church actually hurt our kids. Not Jesus. Yeah. None of this was of Jesus, but how the church actually hurt our kids. And that's what our survey was focused on. Because it's time that we start looking in the mirror. It's time we start looking in the youth group classrooms. It's time we start confronting the truth of the harm that has been done. Because if we don't, it's just going to keep going. And our kids deserve better than this.
Yeah, exactly. Can you speak just briefly about the sort of, what did the survey look like? How many questions was it? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So
just logistics.
It depends. Like, I think it was a minimum 120, but it could have been much more depending on like whether, you're divorced or what, like there's different
branches
you could have gone on. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And we were specifically asking about experiences with sex ed, with teachings around puberty, when body changes, dating rules, and then things that they experienced at church. So messages they heard at church, whether they were abused at church, whether they knew people who had been abused at church. And then we looked at long-term measures of self-esteem, of marital and sexual satisfaction, of rates of sexual pain, of your current marriage, whether you're married to an abuser or not. And so we were able to look at girls who believe certain things as teens and how those beliefs affected them long-term. Mm-hmm.
That's great. So tell me if I'm off base, but as I read this book over the weekend, by the way, I loved it. And as I read it, it was clearly directed at women who are probably like middle-aged now that they experienced purity culture and possibly church harm and even some of those marital and sexual issues that you speak to in The Great Sex Rescue. And they're now parenting their own children, specifically daughters. Would you say that's pretty much who we thought it's geared toward?
Yeah, that's who we thought the book was for. And that's definitely who we wrote it for, you know, was the millennial moms, maybe young Gen X moms who grew up with this and now they're talking with their daughters. And so at the end of each chapter, we have discussion questions and prompts, scenarios, role play stuff you can do with your daughter just to have fun talks about this stuff, but in our launch team, we had so many men reading it, which is great because they just wanted to know what their wives had been taught and also what their daughters had been taught. So that was, and a lot of men have told us, this makes so much sense. I understand why my wife has reacts this way to certain things now. But we also had a lot of younger women reading it just to reparent little 15-year-old me. You know, this is what little 15-year-old me deserves to hear. And I really even have loved the messages of how comforting this has been, how healing the book has been. And how much they feel like, I can see Jesus again. And that's really our goal.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to say was just that I can imagine as you're guiding those moms in sort of how to do things differently, I can imagine how guiding those moms to do things differently, going through this book is very validating for their experience and healing as they're working through that, which is really kind of maybe a beautiful byproduct of the whole thing.
Yeah, I had one woman tell me she was working through the boundaries scenarios with her daughter in our boundaries chapter. And she's like, I didn't even know the answers to a lot of these. Like I had, because we don't give answers. This is like to encourage discussion between moms and daughters.
Right.
And she was like, oh my gosh, I realized how much I need to learn about boundaries. And so even having those discussions with her daughter helped her figure out, okay, you know, this is actually the way we should handle this. Like, oh my goodness.
Right.
Oh my goodness. I need to learn how to say no.
Yeah. That's one thing I find even in the people that I'm surrounded with, I feel like we're all sort of, you know, turning 40 and realizing that we weren't given those tools. We didn't know what boundaries were. We didn't know what consent was. We didn't know all that stuff. And so I love that you've written this book to kind of help us teach our daughters the things that we weren't even given, you know, and that's, I'm sure that's hard. It's hard to learn when you're turning, you know, your middle-aged kind of thing. But it's equally as important for us to learn it as it is to teach our daughters that. So I love that. I want to dig into the themes of the book in just a second. But I just want to share two things that I really loved about the book and feel free to jump in at any point. But the first is that as always, and you've already mentioned this, that it's, your book is so grounded in research. All throughout, you have charts and stats, and it really shows that the survey, the research, really informed your content. And it could have easily been an anecdotal book or a memoir on purity culture. And I think that your research is really what sets it apart and kind of makes it that antithesis of the books that we were all reading as teens, which I appreciate. And just like in The Great Sex Rescue, you know, you're calling out the harmful books, the magazines, the messages, and then offering a different approach or a way forward.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems with a lot of these books in purity culture is they just stated things like they were fact.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you shouldn't kiss till you're married. Okay, well, how do we know that? It's not in the Bible that you don't kiss till you're married. So let's actually measure the effects of that. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens when we tell people, hey, you're not allowed to date. Like, let's actually measure it. What happens? And that's what nobody did until we did. You
know? Yeah, I think they just assumed that by putting these things in place, it would, you know, create the best outcome possible, but they didn't really have any way of knowing that.
And they didn't care. They didn't care because they weren't focused on people's well-being. They were just focused on their ideas of what purity is.
The second thing I loved about the book was the practical sections at the end. You already mentioned that. The conversation starters, the questions, the scenarios that the moms and the daughters can work through together. Just like the quote that I shared earlier, and we've already kind of touched on this, is that I actually know so many moms that are desperate to do things differently, but they don't know where to start. They don't even really know what, and you talk about this in the book, like not wanting to swing that pendulum to the other extreme, but trying to find some middle ground of like, how do we do this in a healthy way? And I think that practical section at the end gives them some sort of like fluid blueprint, if you will, to kind of like know where to start.
Yeah, that's really what we were looking for is, you know, you don't need to get your daughter to read the whole thing. Although if she's 16, 17, she might actually like reading the whole book. It is a really fun
read. Right.
But I think being able to just have really fun discussions with your daughter, and they are fun. It's not like you're just lecturing at her or asking her questions. It's like there's quizzes, there's role playing, there's spot the tricky teaching. It's they're fun. They're
kind of fun. Yeah. I know a lot of my listeners are probably more in the camp of having fully left the church after that purity culture harm. But another thing that I really appreciated about the book was that you, the three of you, you didn't shy away from really relevant, hard topics. You just mentioned it. The section is called the tricky teachings, where you kind of take on those bizarre, quite frankly, bizarre stuff that we're taught in the evangelical church. And then you address abuse and assault and mental health even. And I see that a lot of this book is directed at protecting our daughters from church hurt. So talk to me about the importance of calling out those tricky topics or the hurt in order to protect other generations from it.
Yeah, the simple fact is that a lot of our churches harmed our kids so much that our survey found that many women would have been better off, if you measure in terms of self-esteem and quality of their future marriages, had they never gone to church at all.
Wow.
And that is really scary.
Yeah.
And the strange thing is that overall, religiosity is a helpful thing. And so like, this is such an established fact in psychology. They don't even study it anymore. Like, religiosity is protective. It gives you better marriages. It gives you better sex lives. It gives you better mental health, better relationships, better community. Like, religiosity is great. And we found that too in our survey. You know, church attendance is great until it's not. And the until it's not is all due largely to these terrible teachings or to abuse within the church. And so when we don't call out those things, like, we're really setting kids up for harm. And the church isn't going to get better until we call it out. I totally understand people who have left churches. And, you know, we've left several churches, and we've now settled in a church that looks very unlike the ones that I raised my kids in.
Yeah.
All three of us are going to churches that look very unlike the ones that we were in 10 years ago. And we just really wanted community. And my co-authors who are raising little ones, you know, they did want peers. But when you realize that something is toxic, sometimes the best thing to do is leave. Because if we all left the toxic spaces and we all gravitated to healthy ones, even if those healthy ones are really small, the healthy ones would grow and the toxic ones would shrink. So the toxic ones exist because people prop them up.
Yeah, exactly. One of the themes throughout the book is DARVO, which I love and am familiar with. But tell us what DARVO stands for so that we can all be on the same page, and then talk to us about how the church is or might be DARVOing girls and women.
Yeah, so DARVO is a word that's used a lot in abuse language, and when we're discussing abuse, as the strategy that abusers and abusive systems can use to discredit the accuser. And this isn't necessarily intentional. It's just like, this is the common strategy. This is actually part of abuse. So it may not be intentional per se. It is just the way abusive systems work. And it stands for deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. So, for instance, and we see this all the time, let's take mental health. So deny, you're not actually feeling that. You're not actually upset. You know, you should have joy in the Lord, you know, and attack. Well, if you're depressed, it must mean that you don't have enough faith.
Yeah.
So you just need more faith. And then reverse victim and offender. Don't you realize that you are the only Jesus that your classmates will ever see? And if you're going around being depressed, why would they ever want to know Jesus? Right? So there you go. Yeah. You've got a girl struggling with anxiety, and you've now DARVO'd her. Or you can do it with consent. For instance, you know, boys can't help but lust if a girl is dressed like she's trying to entice it. And then attack, you know, you should know that boys can't stop in a makeout situation. And so what were you doing? What were you even thinking? And then reverse victim and offender. In fact, by starting to make out with him, you put him in an impossible situation. Like, what did you expect him to do? Of course he was going to attack you because he couldn't stop. And that's why we've been warning you so much, you know, but you put him in that situation and now look what happened, you know? Yeah. So it's like, and these are the lessons that we've been giving girls.
I hear a lot of that in the, you know, the kind of headline scandal stuff that's happening within, churches that then the church leadership almost, they're really good at that reverse victim thing, because then they're, you know, anybody that comes forward to report abuse or tell their story is then now attacking the church, you know, and it's like, no one's attacking you. No one's, you know, we're actually just telling the truth, which is not the same thing as attacking.
Exactly. So, exactly.
There were so many cringe moments throughout the book. While I was reading, like hearing those excerpts from all of the 90s, 2000s books and magazines, because I read all of them. I absorbed all of them. Things that were completely normal in my culture and in my circles. But afterwards, they're just so gross. Like, you read them and you're just like, how did we ever absorb that as like truth? It's so scary and gross. I really identified with almost everything in the book. I really did. But I want to give you a chance to talk about the long-term effects of purity culture. I obviously know my own, but and some of my listeners know their own, but just as from the research, what did you find were the long-term effects and what kind of stood out to you the most?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I think a lot of it was people, one of the saddest things we found, especially in our focus groups, because we did the survey, we had the numbers in front of us, but then we wanted to interview women so that we could flesh out stories and put faces to a lot of these numbers. And the number of women that we spoke to who made really bad choices relationally. So they married men that they should never have married. And even at the time, they knew that they shouldn't marry them, but they did it because they felt like they didn't have a choice. So they were told that they had a soul tie because they had had sex, although they hadn't even really had sex. He had date raped her.
Yeah.
But now they had a soul tie. And so she was never going to be able to establish real intimacy with anyone else. And she didn't want to rob someone else of the intimacy that he should get. So she felt like her own chance, her only chance for having children was to marry this guy that she didn't even like. Or girls who were told that dating is only for marriage. And so once you start dating, you've kind of agreed that you're going to marry him. And so they were afraid to break up because their whole community would think that they were, you know, a soiled, damaged goods person because they had dated someone in the past when all of their siblings had just married the first person they'd ever dated, you know, or, people who had gotten married simply because, you know, they had had sex again, but this time, even if it wasn't a date rape situation, they felt like, well, we're now married in God's eyes. And so I don't have a choice.
Right.
And we just heard over and over about that and about date rape. And so those are the kind of stories that really stuck with me. I think the numbers that stuck with me were about the modesty issue, just because of how large the effect size was. Nothing in our survey surprised us in terms of this is harmful or this is not. All the stuff we thought was harmful. Right. Yeah. Guess what? It's harmful. You know, surprise.
Right.
What really surprised us was the magnitude of how bad the modesty messages were. So we measured four different iterations of those. Boys are visual in a way girls will never understand. A boy can't help but lust if a girl is dressed like she's trying to incite it. A girl has a responsibility not to be a stumbling block to the boys around her by what she wears. And a girl who is dressed immodestly is worse than a girl who isn't. So measured all four of those things. All four of them are terrible. Okay. Like just awful. But when we look specifically at the ones that blame girls at least partially for boys' lust. So, you know, stumbling block, boy can't help but lust. What we find is that when girls believe those things, they have a 68% higher chance of marrying an abuser. Like that's huge. They have a 52% higher chance of experiencing sexual pain or vaginismus as an adult. And vaginismus is largely an evangelical problem. We have about 2.5 times the rate of the general population. It's a sexual pain dysfunction where the muscles of the vaginal wall contract and become really tight, making intercourse painful, if not impossible. And evangelical women suffer at about 23%. So that's really large. And one of biggest predictors is believing that you are at least partially responsible for boys lusting after you. Because what does that do? It makes boys dangerous. It makes sex dangerous. It makes your body dangerous.
Yeah.
Like what I am doing might make the world dangerous for me. It might make him lust, which might make him get out of control, and it will be my fault. And so, and you're also being taught boys, no matter how honorable they are, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they say that they love you, they're basically just animals. Yeah. They cannot help but see you primarily as a sexual being. So all your dreams of intimacy, they're just pipe dreams. They're not real because that's not what boys are like. Boys were made to lust. And when we're taught this, when we believe this, it's like, why would any girl want to have, you know, sex? And vaginismus, some people have posited, it's largely a trauma response. It's not intentional. Girls are not trying to do this, but it's our body reacting to protect us. And so our body feels like I am under threat. That's what your body is doing. And by the way, if you suffer from vaginismus, please see a pelvic floor physiotherapist and please read The Great Sex Rescue. So there is help. There honestly is now.
Yeah. I think the other piece of that is like the not only Do you have that sort of fear that you're sort of not even in control of your sexuality, and then the boys are out of control, and it almost feels inevitable that something bad is going to happen to you sexually, but then also mm-hmm. it's your responsibility after that. And so we, as I think females, just naturally, if we've been through this, we've heard these messages, we take that responsibility on ourselves, mm-hmm. That anything that did happen to us is our responsibility. And then even after marriage, if our sex life is struggling, it's really never his fault. It's, mm-hmm. and maybe there's not even a fault, but you know, it's like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you, why can't you, what's going on with you? You know, and it's still somehow, it's all the female's responsibility, that sex isn't, I don't know, as magical as we were promised.
He's the sexual one and she's not. Right. And so she has to fix herself. Yeah. And we definitely measured that. I think it was 68% of girls believed as teenagers that boys can't stop in a makeout situation. And so it is her responsibility mm-hmm. to stop the makeout progression. Yep. And this was taught to us. Like, let me tell you about the book For Young Women Only by Shanti Feldon. Mm. I'm about to give you a statistic. I do not believe the statistic is accurate. I think her question was badly worded. Her possible answers were badly worded. And then the way she grouped the answers was badly done. So none of this is true, but here's what she said. Okay.
Yeah.
82% of boys show either little ability or little responsibility to stop in a makeout situation. Mm-hmm. And the advice that she gives at the conclusion is, if you want to stop, it is safest to not even start. Now let's just be clear. Okay. Let's be absolutely clear. 100% of boys have the ability to stop, and 100% of boys have the responsibility to stop if she says no. Mm. And to say anything else is, I don't have strong enough words for how bad it is.
Yeah.
It is straight up rape culture, and it is unconscionable that she said that to teenage girls. Mm-hmm. And it leads to stories like we opened our consent chapter with, like Vera's, where she was date raped. So she had a migraine. She was basically passed out. And her boyfriend raped her, and she didn't know how to process what had happened. So she goes to her youth pastor, and his response was, well, what did you expect dating a non-Christian? And then the youth pastor's wife, who's only 2.5 years older than her, which is a problem in and of itself, you know, takes two pieces of construction paper, glues them together, waits for them to dry, rips them apart. And so now there's pink paper left on the blue and blue paper left on the pink, and gave her a lecture about how soul ties and how now parts of her soul are tied to him.
Yeah. It's just so gross.
Yeah.
So bad.
And nobody bothered to ask whether it had been consensual. Nobody checked on her like that.
No. Or even just said, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I'm so sorry.
No, they blamed her. They blamed her because she'd had sex. Yeah.
Yeah. This kind of just ties right in, because one of the things that I feel and felt is so insidious is that being sort of on this side of evangelical now and purity culture is how convinced they were and are that all of this was biblical and everything is labeled as biblical. And one of the things that you said in the book that I just really loved was it's a sobering reminder. You're kind of talking about Joshua Harris recanting all of his messaging in I Kiss Dating Goodbye, and how sobering the reminder is, the consequences of claiming that things are biblical truth. Like claiming that a concept is biblical truth that doesn't even appear in scripture. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what's so harmful about youth pastors and things, that they're almost just sort of regurgitating things they've heard as well that someone else claimed was biblical, and no one even bothers to look and see, is this biblical or mm-hmm. is this harmful? You know, they're just out of fear and shame and control, I think, then passing on these messages of shame and things about sex.
Yeah. I mean, the Bible doesn't talk about dating. It doesn't talk. There's so much of the modern context that is just missing from the Bible. And we can't use the Bible for things that it wasn't intended to be used for. I'll tell you what is biblical. It's something Jesus said in Matthew 7. where he said that a bad tree can't bear good fruit and a good tree can't bear bad fruit. And so you can recognize teaching by its fruit. And that's what we're trying to do. We decided we're going to take Jesus at his word and like, we're going to measure the fruit. And that is what is actually biblical. and I wish more people would do that, you know, because there can be honest disagreements on whether things are biblical or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that's hard to understand. Yeah. That's okay. It's good to wrestle through this stuff. But Jesus does tell us that we can judge things by the fruit. And I wish we would do that more, because this isn't just intellectual exercises. These are actual people's lives. And our daughters matter. Their well-being matters.
Right. Yeah. A major part of purity culture was and is this obsession with virginity. This even extends beyond Christian circles. I feel like culture itself, really since the dawn of time, has been obsessed with virginity and sort of even metaphorized it. I don't know if that's a word, but and sort of idealized virginity of women. And at one point you urge the readers not to allow their daughters to believe that their worth is basically boiled down to what they're doing sexually. And I really loved that. I feel like this book is very empowering, which is quite frankly rare in Christian circles to be empowering women. And there's a couple of things that I'd love for you to touch on in this sort of realm of empowerment about girls making choices in relation to their bodies and sex and sexuality. The first one, we've already kind of touched on, but I'll just kind of give you an opportunity to go into more depth is talking about girls being the sexual gatekeepers, and what that does.
And so when you tell a girl that boys can't stop, then you're saying, okay, you need to always be the brakes and he's going to be the accelerator. And that actually impacts women long-term. It means that when they're married, if they get married, you know, that they are so used to being the brakes, they don't know how to be an accelerator. They're more likely to have lower libidos. Sex is something which often is a very high tension thing. You know, it's not something that's comfortable. And so I think instead of talking about gatekeepers, I think it's really helpful to talk to both our sons and our daughters about boundaries. Hey, what do you want to do? What are your boundaries? You know, here's what I would like for you. Here's why I would like this for you. You know, you get to choose once you're a certain age. Once you're below a certain age, you don't get to choose. No, you are just not doing this because this is not good for you. I think, you know, it's okay to say that if someone is 14. You're like below the age of consent. There is a reason.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, but when they're an older teenager, when they're a young adult, they do get to choose for themselves. And that's uncomfortable for parents, I think, a lot. Mm-hmm. But you can say, look, this is what I think. This is why I think it. This is what I want for you. But you're your own person and you need to choose your boundaries and you need to make a plan of how you're going to stick to those boundaries. That's important. What's even more important than that, though, is that you stick to the boundaries of the person you're with and you honor their boundaries. That's the most important thing. And if someone is ever not honoring your boundaries, that's a red flag that relationship isn't safe and you need to get out. And we just need to tell both their sons and daughters that. You know, honor people's boundaries. This isn't rocket science. And if that's what we're focused on, you know, and make a plan for your own. But if we understand that when someone doesn't honor my boundaries, like, you know, if I've said, no, we're not doing that, and he still sticks his hand under my bra, no, we're stopping and we're going home and I'm reconsidering this relationship. It's not just that you're male. It's not just that you're a guy and you can't help it. That was a choice you made. When I said no, when I told you no, that was a choice you made. And even if she didn't say no, because remember that consent is an enthusiastic yes, it's not the absence of a no. Like if she told him before, you know, this is what I want to do, and he pushed her, that's not okay. Mm-hmm. It's also not okay for her to push him either, by the way. And we go over that and she deserves better too, because girls can violate consent as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of goes right into the next question. You're just like teeing these up. I love it. Talk to us about the difference between coercion and consent, because that definitely was not even, I don't think, a concept back in the 90s when I was coming up through all of this, that when you are taught that you are the gatekeeper and you're the brakes and all of these things, then that there is no agency in your, I mean, first of all, you've already signed your sexuality away to your dad and God. And so then you don't have any agency. And so there's no way to discern when you're being coerced or if you've given your consent kind of thing, because you're sometimes you even feel like I'm in the car, I'm in the room. That must mean I've consented to this. Mm-hmm. Right. And it did not translate to us in the 90s that minute by minute, you can change your mind. You can say no, and that needs to be honored. That was definitely not taught to us. Yeah. But I think there's a subtle difference between being coerced and even giving consent. And I know they kind of go together. So kind of talk to us about that.
Yeah. And we do talk about all the different kinds of coercion that can happen in the book. So, you know, when it's someone in a position of authority, all this, one of the ones that I think people misunderstand the most is the gradual wearing down of boundaries. So Kay's story, for instance, so she's making out with her boyfriend and he keeps trying something and she says no. And he stops for like 2 minutes, then tries it again. And she says no. And this goes on and on and on until she realizes her no means nothing. And so she stops saying no. Yeah. And for the next 10 years, she felt like she had consented and she had lost her purity. But had she? You see, a gradual wearing down of someone's boundaries and compliance is not consent. She never gave consent.
Right.
She just simply stopped saying no because there was no point. And we see there's examples of that in Every Young Woman's Battle by Shannon Etheridge. She gives an almost identical story. And then she says, well, what did this girl expect making out in the basement with him? So what did you expect? And that's the message that we got over and over again. Mm-hmm. Another example. So this was actually given by one of the authors of a book, and it doesn't matter which author, we don't mention it, but she was telling of the time that she lost her purity. Okay, but here's how she described the situation. So he was forcing his advances on me. He was doing things that she had said she didn't want to do. She felt like a deer in the headlights. Mm-hmm. But then he awakened desires in her body that she didn't know she had. So if you take all of those things, what you're seeing is she said no. He was forcing her. She was a deer in the headlights, which is the classic freeze response of the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn trauma response. So she's in trauma, but there's this last thing which made her think that she consented, which was that she got aroused. Mm-hmm. And that's called arousal non-concordance. It's very common in sexual assault when your body's aroused, but your mind doesn't want it.
Yeah.
And just because you're aroused does not mean you consented, but she felt like she had. And she tells this story repeatedly as the time that she lost her purity. But you watch any episode of Special Victims Unit, they handle this really well on Law and Order. They talk about, even if you reach orgasm, doesn't mean you consented. And in some ways, for some people, you're actually more likely to get aroused because everything is so heightened. You know, your senses are so heightened because you're in that trauma response. So and our bodies are actually designed to get lubricated to protect us. I'm sorry if that's triggering for some people to hear, because I know that's a great thing to talk about, but you know, it is protective to get lubricated when you are assaulted. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's probably, I mean, I don't have any research, so I'm just kind of talking off the cuff here, but I would think that there's a piece of that sort of when you're taught from the very beginning that your body's dangerous and boys are even sort of dangerous and kind of animalistic, hedonistic kind of, and that's our sort of worldview, is everything is dangerous. Then if any of your sexual experiences are sort of heightened in a dangerous sort of way, a non-consensual way, then that honestly feels normal, because everything about sexuality up until that point has almost been a trauma response, has been dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so it not only can you not help it, but it also just is sort of like, we've almost been groomed to have this sort of response in this sort of scenario, because we're like, oh, well, yeah, they're aggressive and dangerous. And I'm not in control, and he's not in control, and here we are.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And that's actually that's actually something that we measure. That's how we like to talk about a lot of our results. Is I remember I think it was two summers ago now. Singer Matthew West had a song out called "Modest is Hottest," and it got panned. And he had to take it down eventually. But in conversations about it afterwards, I remember he was on a podcast with Ali Beth Stuckey, and they were saying how it was mostly people who had been abused who were triggered by the song. you know, because they were acting out of their trauma. And the point that we make in She Deserves Better is that's not actually what's going on, because the messages themselves are traumatic. That's what we measured. The modesty messages themselves cause trauma. And that's exactly what you're saying. Like, these messages about how boys are dangerous and, you know, you don't have any agency, and that actually has trauma. And we can see the effects in women's bodies. We can see the effects in increased rates of sexual pain, in lower orgasm rates in the future, in lower libidos long term. Our bodies actually carry these messages.
One of the things, just before we wrap up this consent part, is that I loved that you said there isn't a downside to teaching your daughter about consent. Because I know back in the 90s and 2000s, there was almost this fear of, if we give them information, we're basically just arming them to be wild or to be, you know, free sex kind of thing. But I love that we brought that to the forefront, that there really is there's no downside to teaching your child about her body and about consent and about all of these things, because it actually gives her more tools in order to be in control of her own sex life and her own sexuality.
Yeah. You know, I used to write a column in the local paper for like 20 years. I stopped maybe 5 years ago. And I remember writing columns in like the early 2000s against sex ed, comprehensive sex ed, you know, because I thought, we're doing is teaching kids how to have sex. Like, why would we think that they wouldn't do it now? And I regret that so much. Like, you know, so consider this part of my apology for doing that. When you know better, you do better, right? But we measured sex ed terms and asked women, did you know these terms at the point where you graduated high school? Did you know what a female orgasm was? How were you taught about your period? You know, were you taught about consent? Were you taught about date rape? And when you look at all of those things put together, there is, the more kids know, the better they do on every level.
Yeah.
The better they do, the higher their self-esteem. Yeah. When girls have higher self-esteem, they are so much less likely to marry abusers. They are so much more likely to have better marriages and sex lives long-term. When you teach them all this stuff, they are less likely to have multiple sexual partners. Okay. They're less likely to do all the things you don't want them to do anyway, because with high self-esteem tend to make good choices for themselves. And so the more that we can empower our girls, the better. And I'm sure the same holds true for boys too. We just didn't measure it on boys.
I think about like what the kind of what if part of this, and I'm sure this is sort of the aim of the book, is sort of creating this future that we imagine, a different kind of female that is empowered and educated. But I imagine a world where her body changing and her period is actually, you know, puberty is actually celebrated, and it's not this sort of, there's not this fear of period blood, and you know, her no is celebrated, that we're not celebrating compliant females, that we're not celebrating she's so kind and she acquiesces so easily, but instead we're praising her no when she feels empowered to say no and she feels like that's valued. And she's not, I mean, a lot of parenting, I feel like, surrounded almost just behavior modification and even just kind of not talking back kind of thing. But like, what happens if we raise empowered females, daughters that feel strong enough to say no, and they know that that matters and that their body is celebrated and it's not dangerous and all this stuff. Like what would that do to the world? I wonder.
I know. It's amazing how much shame of your period is correlated with all kinds of bad stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think shame of your period makes you 4 times more likely to marry an abuser, which that makes no sense. Like, what's the connection? And it's not that being ashamed of your period makes you marry an abuser. It's something else is going on, which is the types of girls that we're raised to be ashamed often don't know anything about their bodies. They have very, very low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a hot mess. And so the more that we can help our girls feel proud of being a girl, and it's just not a big deal. It's just your body. And your body's good. This is how you're made. Not a big deal. And what you're saying about saying no, I think if I were to distill the whole book into one tiny piece of advice, what I would say to parents is raise girls who can disagree with you. Seriously, just make sure your daughters can disagree with you. It doesn't mean you have to go along with what they say, you know, but let them know they're allowed to disagree. And that's not going to have negative repercussions. Because if your daughter can't disagree with you, if she can't stand up to you, how do you expect her to stand up when she's in an abusive relationship? How do you expect her to leave a workplace that is toxic?
Yeah.
How do you expect her to stand up for friends at school who are being, you know, maligned or bullied or whatever? She has to feel free to say her mind to you before she'll be able to say it to anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so make sure that she can like honor her voice. Cause when we honor girls' voices, they're more likely to use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I love that. That's so good. As we wrap up, kind of nearing the end of our time here together, what is one of, and then you probably just stated it. So if you did, if that was it, then we can just move past this one. But what, in the book, the main themes is the thing that you feel the most deeply?
Oh, I think it's just, it honestly is the girls need permission to be big. That's our last chapter. We have tried to keep girls so small. We have told girls that your job is to be quiet and support the boys around you and learn to honor their leadership. And we've told girls their opinions don't matter. And we need to give girls permission to be big.
Mm.
We need to let our girls know that they weren't just created to be helpers to someone in a subordinate sense, but that they are here because they matter.
And
so we need to give them a chance to matter. And I don't know what that looks like in everyone's home. I think that's going to be different, but I pray that our churches and our communities will be places where girls get to matter.
That's good. What's a theme from the survey results that was maybe the most surprising? Was there anything that, I mean, you kind of said that earlier, that there wasn't really anything. What was harmful, turns out. Mm-hmm. But was there anything that was sort of surprising?
Yeah, actually, there was one thing that I was surprised, again, by the magnitude of it, is how stark the difference was in generations. So I'm Gen X.
Mm.
My two co-authors are millennials. Among boomer women and Gen X women, not dating as a teen was not a thing. Everyone dated pretty much. Everyone had permission to date. Right. Maybe not everyone dated, but it wasn't a thing to not be allowed to date. It certainly wasn't a thing to not kiss before marriage. My generation, Gen X, knew way more sex ed than millennials did. I don't think we understand fully how radical an experiment the church did on millennials.
Yeah.
And the thought that it was like, well, this is how Christians are, and we're just going back to the Christian era. No, that's never been done before. I mean, read Jane Austen. Right. They kissed at engagement. My goodness. No one waited for marriage, okay? Like this was not a thing. And we did this huge experiment on millennials, and it's so stark in our survey results, how different the generations were.
Mm-hmm.
And millennials were far more likely to believe all the toxic stuff as teens than boomer or Gen X women. But today, they are the least likely to believe them, whereas some Gen X and boomers still do. So it's like, because we weren't hurt from it as much, my generation, we still believe it, but millennials were hurt and they've largely abandoned it. So it's really interesting when you look at the difference in generations.
Wow. I wonder if someone was a part of that purity culture and was harmed by it, like maybe speaking specifically to those, to my generation, those millennials, those I heard the other day called like geriatric.
Elder millennials.
Yeah. That's my generation. And whether she was a mother or not, is listening. Like what is the one takeaway that you would want her to have from today?
It was never of Jesus. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
And you have the right to be angry. But one of the things that I pray the most about our book is that when people read it, they'll be able to see Jesus again. Because honestly, I think they stole Jesus from your generation. They made him into someone who was ashamed of you and who was angry at you and who was basically unapproachable.
Yeah.
Unless you were perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And they should never have stolen Jesus from you.
You got me in my feels on that one. Yeah, that's so good. Well, congrats on the book, seriously. And thank you so much for putting it out there. You know, there's lots of purity culture books on the market right now, but I feel like this one is different because it gives us a practical way forward to do things differently. But it also, like we talked about, it just validates our experiences and our stories. And I'm sure that there's, countless others that that could have shared their stories. I wish you all the success. While you deserve to savor this season of book launching, and I'm sure it's a busy season, I have to ask, what's next for you guys?
In the fall, we are starting to write our marriage book, which I'm really excited about. So we're doing a survey this summer. If anyone sees it around social media, please take it. We're doing something different this time. It's going to be really exciting. We're doing a matched pair where both husband and wife take the survey. And there's a way that it can still be anonymous, but we can match the responses to each other.
Nice.
And that's going to let us be able to see all kinds of neat things we haven't been able to see yet. So I'm really, really stoked about that.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. And lastly, where my listeners, friends of all kinds, where can they find you, follow along, and support your work?
Yeah, so baremarriage.com is the website. So B-A-R-E, baremarriage.com. And we have the Bear Marriage podcast every Thursday. If you click on books at baremarriage.com, you'll find The Great Sex Rescue and She Deserves Better and all kinds of other fun things. And my social media links are there. I have a lot of fun. I Twitter is angry me and Instagram is it's not angry as much as it's like I'm there with you in the trenches, me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, yes. Come on over and find me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, friends. Glad we could do this. We'll talk more next time.